saw the injustice, and we took note of the fact that it wearied him. And so his first appeal to God was something like this: God, don't you care about this? And God, what are you going to do? Well, the response of God at once encouraged him that God really did know what was going on, but the response that God had planned for him was one that he had not anticipated, nor did he approve. And so the text tells us that God's response to him was that he was going to allow the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, to come in and, through military conquest, discipline his own people to make them holy. Well, that did not set well with the apostle or with the prophet. The prophet was stunned by it. He couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that God would use someone like this. And he continues in this vein even this morning as he makes his second appeal to God. This is a man who's troubled by what he knows to be true about God and what he knows to be true about God's purpose now. And that's where we find this man. I am speaking to, I think, everyone this morning who's ever said to themselves, or to God rather, God, I wish I knew what you were doing. I'm speaking to people this morning who've said things like, God, I do not know what you want me to do. That's what I think we see this morning in this second section of Habakkuk. I've organized my thoughts this morning around the problem. We'll readdress it, then a new perspective that's required of Habakkuk, and then an old priority, and that's for us. The problem, if you look closely at this section in chapter 1, 12 through 17, there are some things here that I want to point out to you. I want you to notice that Habakkuk understands some things that are very true about God's character. The first one in chapter or verse 12, Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. Now that at surface that doesn't maybe communicate as well as we need it to. This is an attribute of God. He's everlasting. He is steadfast. He's unchanging. He's constant. The God that he's speaking to, he directs that to the covenant-keeping God, Yahweh, the name of the covenant-keeping God of Israel. He is the Holy One of Israel, yes, but it's the fact that he is approaching God as the one who keeps covenant everlastingly that he can say, so I know we shall not die. And yet, part two of that, in spite of the fact that he understands something true about God, God is the everlasting, covenant-keeping, faithful God. He's the one who's made covenant and committed himself to us, so we won't die. And yet, O Lord, have you really ordained them as a judgment? And you, our rock, there's that stability again. Have you established them for a reproof? The second thing we learn about the character of God from him, he's in verse 13. You are the one who is of purer eyes than to see evil, and you cannot look at wrong. You are the Holy One of Israel. You are so holy that you cannot see evil. You certainly wouldn't approve of it. You can't look on wrong. And yet, here's the quandary. And yet, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? I would say, if you can summarize the problem here in this section, it's right there in that second part of verse 13. Why do you look at traitors? He's speaking of the Babylonians. Why do you remain silent when the wicked, this is it, when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? In covenant terminology in the Old Testament, it might be summarized like this, in a phrase that's repeated often, either explicitly or implicitly, where God comes to a people and he says, I will be your God and I will make you my people. That's the idea of the covenant. God has made a promise that he's going to have a people, that he's going to be their God. He's committed to them being who they are in the earth. And what the Old Testament shows us and the New Testament puts on glorious display is that God has committed himself to both parts of that phrase. He has committed himself to be their God, and he has committed himself to his unfailing faithfulness to love them on one hand and to keep them in his love on the other. So when Habakkuk talks about God in verse 12, saying of God that you are the everlasting one, you are the God who keeps covenant, he is really focusing his attention on the fact that God has committed himself to be faithful in love to his people. And in that, he takes hope. I know we will not all ultimately perish. That's what he's thinking through. We move on a little bit further down in this particular passage, and we find out the problem there is that in spite of the fact that God is holy, in spite of the fact that God has committed himself, he still is confused about how this holy God, who is everlasting in his faithfulness and his commitment to love them, has ordained for this vile people to be the rod that brings correction. When I read this section, it's almost like I see the prophet having a discussion with himself that I have with myself often. He's just trying to make sense in his brain and his heart of all the dots. If every dot is a piece of data, he's just trying to figure out how does it all fit together. And he's saying something like this. He says, all right, I know what is true of God. Think. I know that God is everlastingly faithful to us. I know that. And so I know because of that, that we will not ultimately perish. I know that. And I also know that God is holy and cannot look on wrong. I know that. But that's not helping me understand why he has ordained them for judgment and reproof on us. In the light of the fact that God is everlastingly faithful, how in the world could 13b be possible? How could God have ordained the wicked to swallow up those more righteous than they? And that's the quandary that we find Habakkuk in. Chapter 1, when God says, when God describes Babylonians, he says they're drunken, arrogant, restless, greedy, and dissatisfied. They're thieves. They're heartless, they have no conscience, and they fear nothing. Habakkuk says, as we read on in this particular end of chapter 1, he says that compared to Babylon, the people of the earth are like fish of the sea, and Babylon is going to capture them with a hook or with a dragnet, and the doing of it will be the cause of their great rejoicing and gladness. Verse 15. In other words, this is a nation that is entertained by catching people in their traps. What's more, if Judah is idolatrous in their worship practices, and Habakkuk took note of that in chapter 1, he's looking at Babylon and he's thinking, well, if Judah is guilty in their worship practices, Babylon is an idolatrous people as a way of life. I mean, these people, figuratively speaking, they're sacrificing to their net and make offerings to their dragnet, for because of them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Verse 16. Now Habakkuk sees this as a great injustice. There's another insight here in verse 17 that we should take notice of. Those two things are true about God. That's absolutely true. And I would add this, that this week we're going to see how God responds in terms of him being everlastingly faithful. And next week, the second half of chapter 2, we will look at how God responds to the truth that he is holy. So we're looking, our focus of our attention this morning is on this first thing that he says about God in verse 12 that he tries to take hope in. I know that God is committed to his people. So I know ultimately we're not going to be extinguished from the earth. Nevertheless, he cannot make sense of the evil that is coming. And yet here in verse 17, we learn something that he's going to have to think differently about. Because Habakkuk here doesn't understand what we learned last week, that at times God will allow a temporary moment of discipline to come in to his people in order to bring about good for them. It's temporary, but he doesn't understand that. And so what is happening in a temporary measure, he begins to see as a new normal, and that just brings more distress to his soul. You see that in verse 17? So God, if you're going to do that, if you're going to give him a license, if you're going to give him a license to come in here and hunt Israelites, does that mean that he's going to keep emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? That sounds just like me. Oh, what does that mean? It's the worst possible thing. That's what he's saying. He doesn't understand that God might allow something in a temporary measure in order to bring about some good. He sees if God allows it at all, God has turned his back on his people. We are toast. You can feel his despair. I hope that you feel the weight of his confusion and his frustration. How can this be? Well, what he doesn't understand is that God's going to answer that question in verse 17 with a negative. The rest of the chapter is going to spell out for us, though we don't see it this morning in our view, in the text that we've chosen, but he will answer the question. It will be an emphatic no. No. It does not mean that he's going to keep emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever. No, not forever. But Habakkuk doesn't know that yet. That's the problem. I hope that you can identify with the frustration. How can God do this? Understand that Habakkuk is giving an opportunity to have this kind of interaction with the divine counsel that you and I do not have. This is being recorded for us so that his experience with God can be our education, so that we can be exhorted and edified by what we're learning here. But he is having this moment of this interesting interaction with God in which God is revealing to him how the cause and effect relationship of the Babylonians coming in connected to the need for the people of God to be chastised, disciplined, a trial. The second thing I want to point out to you is there's a need for a new perspective here. So that's the problem, and a new perspective. Let's remember what Habakkuk has forgotten. I've already mentioned it, but let's mention it again. He first appealed to God because of the injustices and the ungodliness that had filled Israel to the point that the righteous were being oppressed by the wicked. The righteous were nearly being consumed. And that's what he was calling for God to do something. God, what are you going to do about this? This is a mess. What are you going to do? Don't you care? You remember that? Well, now he's calling upon God to bring correction, yes, but to do it in a particular way. See, Habakkuk wants God to do something locally. He wants him to purge the wickedness by just having those that are guilty addressed. The rest of us, he's thinking, should go pretty scot-free. But that's not the way God works. He needs a very different perspective on two things at least. Let me just recommend two. First, Habakkuk understands that God is the everlasting covenant-keeping God, but he doesn't understand yet. He needs a new perspective on God's commitment and what it is. Chapter 1 introduces this. Introduced us to the weariness of the prophet, and we assume that his heart is being broken about the people's behavior and this for the same reasons that God's heart is being broken. But then in chapter 2, we begin to wonder whether this is actually the case. And I would suggest to you that it is very possible, I think even probable, that Habakkuk's initial complaint to God was far more personal than it first appeared. That God, in the Old Testament, in the law, he promised his people prosperity and flourishing if they would walk in his ways. And now, they're not walking in his ways. And now difficulties are coming socially. Due to their disobedience and their rejection of God's law, prosperity is now being threatened. Or it's actually been removed. And so now he's crying out to God to do something that could restore prosperity. I don't think that's out of bounds here. I think there's something like that that's happening. It's like a modern nation that we all know very well. We can become weary looking out over the culture of that particular nation, one that we live in. We can look at the moral condition of our country. We can look at this commitment to spiritual suicide. We can look at the moral and social disaster that we live around. And it moves us to say, the economy, the economy. If you can understand that, you can understand Habakkuk. I think something like that is going on. God hears him, but he doesn't respond in the way that Habakkuk expected. He didn't respond in the way that Habakkuk is looking for. But neither is God chiefly committed to the cause that Habakkuk is chiefly committed. And so, Habakkuk's theology is correct, but his perspective is too narrow, it's too limited. He looked to the punishment of the wicked so that the prosperity of his people could be assured. But God looked to the punishment of Habakkuk's people so they could be restored to a covenant relationship with him. Oh, there's a big difference. It's true that God is a blessing to his people and that blessings come to those who are connected to God. But it is not true that those blessings are mechanical, as if you do this thing and then that preferred thing happens. And it's simply not true that God is more concerned with those blessings than he is the hearts of those who are his. And that's going to take a big perspective change for Habakkuk. The second thing that I would suggest to you that there needs to be a difference of perspective has to do with the place of personal loss. This is his second complaint to God. And then, if you'll look along, follow along in chapter 2, he says, I've made my complaint to God. And he says, in an almost comical way, now I'm going to go wait and see what God's going to say about what I've said. And then he says, and then I'm going to kind of be on guard to see what I'm going to say to what God says about what I said. So I'm going to go watch, like a watchman on a wall, looking out for an enemy army. And I'm going to see how God responds. And I'm going to prepare myself for my response to God. And it was there that God gave him a vision. He told him to write it down. Verse 2. Because what God was going to do was not going to happen immediately. And so by God's grace, he says, I want you to write down what I'm going to show you. Because when this happens, I want my people to find great hope in the fact that I already said it would happen, that I'm controlling all things, that I am overseeing this time of trial and suffering in their lives. And so I want you to write it down, because the time of the visitation is coming. And when it comes, they will take greater hope in God. And then he writes in verse 3, for still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. And there's something that we learn here about God's purposes. They may not be immediate, but they are always certain. This helps us to see another area in which the perspective of Habakkuk is underdeveloped. It has to do with personal loss. He wanted God to do something to them. The them were those that were living in disobedience to God. But God is going to do something about them by allowing something bad to happen to us. And that's really what's provoking this sense of injustice. The expansion of this perspective itself is a trial. Anytime God has us in a place where he's trying to stretch our perspective and help us to understand that things aren't the way that you thought they were in our understanding of God, that itself is a trial. It's an inward trial, yes. It's an intellectual trial, yes. But it's a trial of our faith. It's a trial of our trust. Who is this God? Why does he do these things? How does he act? What is predictable? It's a trial. He's being stretched. It's oftentimes a very difficult trial when God begins to do the very thing that we confess him to be. Think about that. I think what's happening here with Habakkuk is that he has always said that God is the everlasting God who keeps covenant. But when God actually is the everlasting God who keeps covenant, and he's being faithful to that in ways that he didn't expect, it produces a real angst in his soul. But in truth, God is being exactly who he's confessed him to be, just not in the way that he thought that he would. So God is raising up the Babylonians, not just to correct them, but to benefit us. And to see that well, it's going to take a real change of perspective. And in order to truly love his people, God is going to allow difficulties and trials that he has chosen in order to correct their waywardness. And he does that to us as well. He does it in order to correct our waywardness, refine our hearts, so that we might share in his holiness, and he might conform us to the image of Christ. He does this as an act of his everlasting faithfulness, and that is a perspective that all of us are in need of embracing. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 3 through 11. Here's what the text tells us. speaking to us about the way that God disciplines those he loves. Here's the word of the Lord. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. Because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastises every son who he receives. You see, it is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father did not discipline? If you are left without discipline in which you have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they, that is our earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them. But God disciplines us for our good, that we might share in his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. This is not, what we're seeing in Habakkuk is not new. It's just simply a different way of Habakkuk of seeing how God actually works. Now, this passage in Hebrews is made somewhat difficult by the use of the word discipline. In our minds, I think oftentimes we think of discipline nothing more than just punishment. But that's not really what that word means. The word is paideia, and we talked about paideia in different contexts. It's actually a word that I think could be understood like nurture or like training, not just punitive. It's actually a word that encompasses kind of all things that are necessary to properly train our children to walk in the ways of the Lord, to grow in virtue and grow in character. And so it includes education, and it also includes all of the training necessary morally in order to bring our children to that place. So it's a big word. But this is the word that's being used here. God trains his people. God trains the son that he loves. If he's training you by allowing trials, allowing difficulties, or in the case of Habakkuk, when he brings a judgment against his own people because they're wayward hearts, he's doing that because he loves them, not to punish. He's the everlasting God. He'll be faithful to his covenant forever. And Habakkuk knows that means they will not be ultimately eliminated from the face of the earth. They will always be a remnant because God is faithful. So what we're seeing in Habakkuk, whether we can see it with these eyes or not, what we're seeing is an act of God's love and commitment to love his people. You see, that's the only way that Romans 8, those great verses in Romans 8, 31 through 39, can be true. They are true because God has committed to making them true by his commitment to us, his people. Those texts. If God is for us, who can be against us? In your own mind. Answer that question. Well, I'm thinking, well, let's see. There's a couple of things I can think of. And the writer, Paul, moves on to say, you don't understand what I'm saying. I'm talking about ultimate things. I'm talking about ultimate things that make a difference in the here and now. Who, if God is for us, who can be against us? Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness, or danger, or sword, all those things that we fear, cannot separate us. As is written, for your sake we're being killed all the day, we're regarded as sheep to be slaughtered, and that's how it must feel to be under trials and difficulties, for sure. But the answer is no. In all of these things that we so fear, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things that are present, nor things that are to come, nor powers, nor heights, nor depths, nor anything else in all creation is able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. And the reason that is true is because God is committed to love you. This is what God has committed himself to in his relationship to his people. That is to be a father to us. So he has committed to keep our hearts in tune with his own. In his faithfulness, he has promised to bring correction. In his faithfulness, he has promised to intervene. He has promised to allow circumstances that He controls that are designed to purify and to renew our gift of spiritual sight so that we can see Him and His purposes and we can see and celebrate His glory. And those things are also designed to restore our spiritual hearing so that we might be sensitive again to the Word of God and to the will of God and to the purposes of God. But friends, there are so many in our generation whose view of God as loving does not allow for such a view of God's love. There are many who suffer from an anemic view of God's love, one that has no place for what kind of love we see in Habakkuk. In the modern view, if you love me, you will allow me and help me to have my own way. But in a biblical sense of love, He loves me by making sure I don't have my own way, because so often what I think I want and need will just ruin me. So we have a Father who knows what's best for us. A Father who decrees and allows what is good for us, even when it hurts. And that is going to take a perspective change for this prophet to see. Habakkuk is struggling to embrace this. He sees this trial that's coming as God's rejection. But do you see that it's just the opposite? For some, every act of God and God's discipline seems punitive. It seems like He's judging. It seems like He's just waiting to smite me. Many, some here, have struggled to really embrace the love of God as it's displayed for us in the gospel. And so many struggle to view God that way. They go through their life thinking that God is somehow hovering over them. He's just watching you. He's just waiting for you to mess up. He's just waiting to expose you. He's just waiting to humiliate you. He's just waiting to show you you really don't measure up. And that's some people's view of God. And that's so far from what we understand from the Bible. They don't know anything of His everlasting faithfulness. They're blinded to one of the most wonderful truths in the gospel, and that is this, that when Jesus takes on our penalty in His own flesh, the payment was paid in full. And that means not only are we released from the penalty of our sin, but the relationship between our sin and punishment is changed forever. That's one of the beautiful truths of the gospel. There is no longer a punishment for your sin. God is not looking to smite you. He's not ready to expose you. He's not ready to punish you for those sins committed in the flesh. Those have all been in Christ. Now, your relationship to suffering changes forever. It is a permanent thing. Will God allow difficulties to come into our lives? Yes. Are they controlled under His sovereignty? Yes. Are they for good purposes in your life? Yes. Do they always seem good at the time? Never. We were talking downstairs, Sunday school. How many of us really want God to humble us so low that it breaks our pride forever? It's at those moments that we find ourselves being a little bit more comfortable with our pride than we would like. God in His love would seek to come into our lives and to arrange things so that we would be humble. Well, those things that He might use to humble me are not things I stay up at night hoping for. Well, that, my friends, is what's going on with Habakkuk, and he doesn't understand. He only thinks that when troubles come, God has rejected him. He doesn't understand that because troubles are coming, it's proof that God owns them. They are His. Habakkuk didn't see that. Habakkuk was hoping that God would squash this isolated evil. God wanted to purge the tolerance of Israel from injustice. Habakkuk wanted a local judgment for the good of the economy. God wanted to allow affliction in a way that would turn their hearts to Him. They were not on the same page. They saw the same problems. They were not going to respond to them the same way. God is indeed pleased to be the giver of good gifts, but he's never pleased to be the giver of good gifts to the exclusion of himself as the gracious giver and lover of our souls. And that is going to take a change of perspective for Habakkuk to see. He'll see it, chapter 3, but he doesn't see it in chapter 2. Finally, there's an old priority here. God does not leave this prophet alone with his thoughts any longer. He doesn't leave him in a place where he was in chapter 1, where he's reeling with all these crazy ideas. He speaks, and his word brings forth hope, even in the midst of a difficult trial. It brings forth some hope. And what we're going to see now, as we look carefully at what is happening in Habakkuk, is we're going to have to ask ourselves this question. Do you really believe that God's holy and everlasting love is working in you to produce greater godliness and a greater glory for himself? Now, I think in order to go forward, I think it's only right that I ask you to sit in silence for just a moment. I want you to think about a particular trial in your life, one that you've gone through or one that you're going through, a struggle with sin, a struggle to understand, a struggle to relate well, a struggle to respond well, a struggle with some abiding sin. You keep finding yourself going back to that place. And I want you to think about it in this way. Do you see that trial? Is God exposing because he loves? Do you see that trial? Is God using that to expose something in your own heart because he loves you? How do we enter into times of trial? How do we endure trials? What does God expect of us in the midst of them? When the Babylonians are coming as an act of God's precious and purifying love, how is Israel supposed to respond to that? Well, now we come to the key verse of this entire book. It's found in chapter 2, verse 4. Here's the verse. Behold, take a look. Notice this. His soul is puffed up. It's not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. This verse is in making a contrast between the righteous man and, I think what's implied here, is either King Nebuchadnezzar or the personification of Babylon. Babylon is a man who's puffed up. Babylon is a man who's not, his heart is not right within him. His soul is puffed up. He is unrepentant. And God knows that. And these verses are implying that there's going to be a judgment against Babylon, and the rest of chapter 2 is going to describe it for us around five woes. We'll look at it next week. In other words, God has not found pleasure in them, even while he is using them to love us. And in contrast to that, the righteous shall live by faith. Babylon is puffed up, they're arrogant, but the righteous shall live by faith. Babylon is living by their own might and power and their own strategies, but the righteous shall live by faith. Babylon is going to be used to be the one who brings judgment, but the righteous one, the one that's enduring the judgment himself, is going to live by faith. And in the midst of this context, we begin to see what a precious thing this verse actually is to us. You say, well, what does it mean? Well, it's speaking of faith. And faith does not mean some shallow belief in something. It doesn't mean something we acknowledge. It doesn't mean that. It means trust. The kind of faith that God here describes and the New Testament authors promote is the continual trust in God, in clinging to God's promises and his revealed character, even in the darkest days. So the unrighteous man will live by his own power, but the righteous will live by their continual trust in God and clinging to God's promises and his revealed character, even in the darkest of days. Even in the midst of the Babylonian invasion, the righteous will live by a continual trust in the God who makes promises and has revealed himself in a particular character, even in the darkest moments, even in the hardest moments, even in the midst of the trials, even in the midst of humility. That's what you're going to believe, because that's what faith does. Habakkuk, I know you're squirming right now, but the righteous will live by faith. The righteous will live by a continual trust in the God who has made promises and revealed himself and will not leave you. That's the way the verse is used when it's quoted in Galatians 3 and 11. And there, faith is depicted again as a wholehearted commitment to God. A wholehearted commitment to God. When God uses your rival to humble you. A wholehearted commitment to God. In other words, the righteous will not live by their affluence and the security that they can buy. The righteous will not live by their self-sufficiency. The righteous will not live by the strength of their moral life. The righteous will not live by their ability to manipulate God's good gifts. The righteous will live through trials and through difficulties and through God's corrections and God's purifications by clinging to God alone. We will live by our wholehearted commitment to God, who's everlastingly faithful to His covenant love. The righteous shall live by that kind of faith. But then we have to ask, if we're to live by faith, and this is to be good news to us, why does it seem like that phrase puts all of the weight on me? Why does it seem like the righteous are to live by their wholehearted commitment to God? That is, I will find life to the extent that I am wholeheartedly committed to Him. That is, if I'm wholehearted enough, I will find life. Or if I'm committed enough, then I will find life. And that's just the same old thing the Pharisees were saying. My friends, that's not really what this is saying at all. What it's saying to us, based on what Habakkuk says about God as being the one who's eternally faithful to His people, the righteous shall live. They shall live by their faith in God's faithfulness. That's what that verse means. The righteous shall live by faith in God's faithfulness. The righteous will live by a wholehearted commitment to the fact that God is faithful. The righteous will live by a wholehearted commitment that God is more faithful than we are miserable. That God is more faithful than we are faithless. That God will be faithful even when we can't find faith. God will be faithful to love us even when we're trying to run. Psalm 139. How does the psalmist know that no matter where he goes in this world, God is there? Because He's been everywhere. And why is God so determined to be all places except He's tracking down His people? He will not let you go. That's how God loves us. So how is it that we should live then? How is it that we're supposed to live under trials? How is it that we're supposed to live when troubles come, when difficulties arise? Well, first, we're supposed to remember what James said. James 1, verse 2. Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you face trials of various kinds. Why? Because the testing of your faith produces something in you. It produces. It's not wasted. God is not playing games with your life. He's producing something through every kind of trial, test, every kind of difficulty, everything that comes our way that's bad news or good news, God is using in order to bring about steadfastness. And when steadfastness runs its course, we will find ourselves in a place where we are perfect, he says, and complete, lacking nothing. How in the world does James say such a thing, except for maybe he's read Habakkuk? I think he has. Friends, this is how we live under disappointment, considering all joy, because God's going to use this. This is how we live when our comforts are removed. We consider it all joy, because God's at work in this. This is how we live when our economy is rotten. This is how we're to live when the political climate is all against us. When we are wearied by the world that we live in, how are we going to endure? How are we going to live through that? You're going to live through it, first and foremost, by recognizing God is in this. God is the one who's eternal and everlasting in His covenant commitments. He loves us more than we love Him. This is how you're going to live when the diagnosis isn't what you planned. You didn't give anyone permission to have that diagnosis. How are you going to live? What are you supposed to do? This is how you live when you feel alone, when you feel rejected, when you feel isolated. God is in this. This is how you live when you're being taught how to live by faith. Consider it all joy, brothers. God is at work. See, this is what Paul writes to us in 2 Corinthians 4:16. Paul was subjected to so many difficulties. And yet he's such a model for us on how to consider it all joy by seeing that there's something purposeful in it. That takes faith. It takes faith in God's faithfulness to go through our trials with joy. And that's what James is getting at. And so Paul writes to us in 2 Corinthians 4:16, he was subjected to injustices his entire ministry. I mean, I read 2 Corinthians and I read the list of things that happened to him and I just think, oh God, thank you for saving me from that. He was shipwrecked. He was persecuted. He had the lack of basic needs. He was hated by people that he was trying to give the gospel to. Gossip nearly wrecked the ministry. And he just rejoiced that the gospel was being preached, even if people were using it as a tool to make trouble for him. And I look at that man and I say, what is wrong with him? And I realize there's an old priority that he's operating as, the priority of believing and trusting in God, who's more faithful than we think. His response is not bitterness. His response was not misery. He writes this way. He says, we do not lose heart. Even with all of those things being true, we don't lose heart. Even when our outward self is wasting away, literally being destroyed, our inner self is being renewed day by day. He sees that the light and momentary afflictions that he suffers is preparing him for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. And he actually goes through life believing that. He actually goes through life believing that whatever comes my way is by God's design, allowed for a temporary period of time for my good. It is a light and momentary interruption in my life for the purpose of building something beyond all comparison. It is an eternal weight of glory. That's the faith that Habakkuk's going to have to embrace. Or Habakkuk's never going to see that God is good. So regardless of the hardships, his ability to see the permanent working of God in him is more important than light momentary afflictions. And through these things that he would not desire, God is working something good and glorious in him. He is at work in you. He who promised, who began a good work, who promised to be faithful, that faithful to see it through to the end, he is loving you in the midst of every trial of your life. There is not a single thing that happens to you outside of his sovereignty. And Habakkuk is learning that in a really difficult context. He is learning that in the ER waiting room, and that is a terrible place to have to grapple with this. God is in this. He's working this out for my good. I just wanted him to take out the politicians. I didn't want him to purify my heart. Paul sees this by faith. He's not playing a game with reality. He's seeing something that's true that escapes the natural man's eye. He's seeing God at work in him. He looks back over his life, I suspect, and he says, oh, yeah, I remember that shipwreck. I remember the second one. I remember being beaten 39 times, first and second times. Third one, I wasn't quite with it, but I remember that. And God was doing something in me that loosened my grip on this world. God was doing something in there that's ultimately valuable to me, even though I didn't like it. The righteous shall live by faith. The righteous shall live by trusting that God is as faithful as he says he is. The righteous will live by this kind of faith.
trusting in the eternal faithfulness of God. And that's how the righteous face troubles. They do it with faith.
John Newton has written for us a song that we have been waiting for a long time to try to introduce. We sang it this morning. It walks through the theology or the theological lesson of Habakkuk. If you'll allow me to change the words just a bit. I'm not a poet, so I want to change the poetry of a poet so it fits. Verse 1 says, I asked the Lord that I might just grow in faith and love and every grace. I wanted to be like Jesus. So I asked Him, God, make me like Your Son. I asked Him that I might have a more keen awareness of His glorious salvation, that I might seek His face more earnestly. These were good things. So I was having a good day. And I said, oh God, teach me to love You. Teach me to believe You. Verse 2 says, it was Him who taught me to pray this way. But the way that He chose to answer this prayer nearly led me to despair. Habakkuk. Verse 3, I hoped that in some favored hour, that He would at once, instantaneously, answer my request, subdue my sins, and give me rest. I was hoping that on Wednesday at 2, He'd just make me holy. That's what I was thinking. Lord, I've got a calendar date for You. Make me holy at 2. That was my hope, he says. I hope that in some favored hour He would do it. But in verse 4, instead of this, He made me feel the hidden evils of my heart. And He allowed the anger powers of hell to assault my soul in every part. I asked Him to make me holy, and God nearly destroyed me. He let the demons have their way with me. He revealed to me things that I didn't know about my own soul that I hadn't thought of since grade school. It was all coming out. All I did was say, God, I want to be more like Jesus. Verse 5, what is more? It seemed that He was content to aggravate my difficulty Himself. He made sure that all the plans that I had made, my strategies to get out of this pickle, had failed. And then He humbled me and laid me low. In verse 6, and I asked, why is this? In my humility that He brought me to, I saw myself as a worm. And I asked Him, will You pursue Your worm even to death? I mean, how low do I have to go? And He said, no. And then the Lord said, no, not at all. But this is the way that I answer Your prayer for grace and faith. This is the way I answered a prayer, Your prayer, that You might know the glories of my salvation and the joy of seeking my face with earnestness. Verse 7, God speaking, it's in these inward trials that I employ, that I free you from self and pride. And it's in this way that I break your schemes to find your superior joy in earthly things, so that you might find the greatest of joy in Me. It takes faith to be okay with that process. But that's how God grows us up. In other words, this is the way my commitment to love You is worked out in everyday life. And you will live by your wholehearted trust in God's everlasting faithfulness to do this in you. That's the message of Habakkuk. So I ask you, friends, how does this chapter prepare you for tomorrow's trials? It's not enough for us to come and say, oh, that was really neat. How did you just get prepared for this afternoon? How do you really handle trials when they come? And when they come, how do you go about expressing your wholehearted commitment to His faithfulness in the midst of it? As Christians, I honestly believe that each of us here ought to be challenged. As we look the last 2 weeks of Habakkuk, I challenge you with a challenge that came to me from David Pollison just last week. Are you a person who is willing to be brought to the place where you are unafraid of bad news? Are you willing to be the kind of Christian who responds with a firm and steady heart, who trusts in the Lord, and again, who is not afraid? Because our fear undermines our desire to be like Him. In Habakkuk, God wants you to see Him. He wants you to see in Him what will free you to face tomorrow with hope. He wants you to see that the righteous shall live by their wholehearted trust in His faithfulness. He does not want you to make a plan to survive. He wants you to make a plan to trust Him. And I wonder, is that us? Is that you? Is that me? If not, what must you believe about the gospel that will set you free to trust Him that way? Do you believe the gospel? Really believe the gospel? Do you really believe that He sought you out? Do you really believe that everything necessary for you to have a relationship with God is in the gospel? His plan, His son, His idea, and you belong to Him. Do you believe that your relationship to punishment has changed forever when you are a Christian? Do you believe in His commitment to love you? Do you believe that He is sovereignly using everything in your life in order to bring you to that place, that you love the joy of His salvation more and earnestly seek His face? Do you believe that nothing can separate you from His love, and that these light and momentary afflictions in this life are preparing in us an eternal weight of glory? Do you really believe that they're doing something? Because I would say to you, that's the message of Habakkuk. They're doing something. It's not for fun. They're doing something. There's a purpose in it, and it's loving. My friends, it takes a lot of faith to believe that. But it took a lot of faith for Habakkuk, too, to understand that the righteous must live by their faith. Their faith in the everlasting God who keeps His covenant forever. Let's stand.